When I think about the most profound influences in my life, movies stand at the center. Like many film lovers, I often find myself comparing real experiences to movie scenes, making sense of my reality through fictional narratives. This phenomenon isn't just entertainment, it's a fundamental way we process the world. In Alicia Malone's Girls on Film, she explores this intimate relationship between cinema and identity through her own journey from movie-obsessed child to film historian. Her story resonates with anyone who's ever felt transformed by what they've seen on screen. The book has struck a chord with celebrities and critics alike. Emma Stone called it a moving exploration of how films shape who we become, while Martin Scorsese praised its deeply personal understanding of cinema's emotional power. Beyond critical acclaim, it arrives at a crucial cultural moment when we're reassessing representation in media and questioning how the stories we consume influence our self-perception. For the millions who find themselves reflected or conspicuously absent in the films they watch, Malone's introspective journey offers both validation and a framework for examining our own relationship with the moving image. Our earliest movie experiences often leave the deepest impressions. For Malone, it began at age 3 with The Neverending Story, a traumatic yet mesmerizing introduction to cinema's emotional power. The experience of watching Artax sink into the swamps of sadness initiated her into the world of movies, where fictional characters could provoke very real tears. This emotional connection to cinema would define her relationship with film throughout her life. As a young girl, Malone found particular inspiration in National Velvet, where Elizabeth Taylor plays Velvet Brown, a determined girl who disguises herself as a male jockey to win the Grand National Race. This film sparked Malone's own horse riding ambitions, demonstrating how powerfully movies can shape children's aspirations and self-concept. The freedom Taylor's character experienced resonated with what writer Ashley Wells calls cowgirl narratives, stories showing women who are at home in their bodies, connected to nature, and disrupting traditional gender roles. What's particularly striking about these childhood influences is how they operate beneath conscious awareness. Young viewers absorb not just the explicit messages, but the implicit values embedded in these narratives. Taylor's journey to stardom through National Velvet itself tells a compelling story, her relentless campaign to win the role despite initial rejection due to her size, followed by her entry into MGM's family under Louis B. Mayer's patriarchal leadership. These behind-the-scenes realities often mirror the power dynamics portrayed on screen. The classic films featuring heroic young girls, Margaret O'Brien in The Secret Garden, Judy Garland in The Wizard of Oz, taught lessons about courage and determination. Yet these positive messages existed alongside troubling realities. Child stars like Garland endured exploitation, medication with pep pills, and abbreviated educations that left them unprepared for adulthood. Their off-screen stories frequently ended in multiple marriages, financial troubles, and emotional breakdowns, a stark contrast to the hopeful narratives they portrayed. As we grow, our relationship with these formative films evolve. What once seemed like simple entertainment reveals layers of meaning and problematic elements. The movies that shaped us as children continue to influence our worldview long after we've outgrown them, operating as reference points against which we measure our own experiences and expectations. The transition from childhood to adolescence marks a crucial period when we actively seek models for who we might become. For many, especially those who feel different or out of place, movies provide these templates. Malone's fascination with Marilyn Monroe in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes exemplifies this phenomenon, a young girl captivated by an exaggerated performance of femininity that seemed both aspirational and safely distant from reality. Gentlemen Prefer Blondes opens with Monroe and Jane Russell performing Two Little Girls from Little Rock, establishing the film's subversive theme of women using their assets to get ahead in a man's world. Monroe plays Lorelai Lee, a blonde who pursues millionaires while her friend Dorothy, Russell, chaperones her on a transatlantic voyage. Beneath its glamorous surface, the film delivers sharp commentary on gender economics, particularly in the iconic Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend number, which acknowledges women's limited financial options in the 1950s. What makes Monroe's performance particularly fascinating is the gap between persona and person. Behind the blonde bombshell image was Norma Jean Mortensen, who actively crafted her Marilyn character through years of dedicated work. Unlike her co-star, Jane Russell, whose sex symbol image was dictated by producer Howard Hughes, Monroe had significant agency in creating her persona, sometimes referring to Marilyn in the third person. This transformation began in childhood when her guardian, Grace McKee, took her to movies and told her she would grow up to be like Jean Harlow. The process of becoming somebody else holds powerful appeal for many, especially shy or uncertain young people. Through watching Monroe's films, Malone learned how blonde hair functioned as a symbol in cinema, representing various stereotypes from dumb blonde to ice goddess. This awareness of constructed identity led her to explore other female stars transformed by Hollywood: Rita Hayworth, born Margarita Consino, and Judy Garland, born Frances Gumm, and eventually to plan her own transformation. What's often overlooked in these cinematic role models is how they're shaped by the predominantly male gaze. Classic Hollywood was dominated by male decision makers, and female stars, despite their power, still had to appeal to the men in charge. This reality creates a complex legacy for viewers who find inspiration in these performances while recognizing their problematic aspects, a tension that continues to shape our relationship with media figures today. Despite cinema's reputation as a communal experience, many passionate film lovers begin their journey in isolation. Malone's high school attempt to start a film club illustrates this paradox. Her fervent desire to share classic cinema with peers who showed no interest in Citizen Kane, after transforming a sports vice captain badge into a film club president badge and securing her film studies teacher's classroom for after-hours screenings, she found herself alone, her enthusiasm for deep focus photography insufficient to draw an audience. This experience highlights the peculiar loneliness of the young cinephile. Classic cinema became Malone's secret escape from life, yet her passion made her an outsider among peers. Simultaneously, she didn't fit into the established world of film appreciation, which seemed dominated by older white men. The absence of women speaking about classic films left her without clear role models for how to channel her passion professionally. The solitary nature of serious film watching creates a particular kind of knowledge, one that feels both precious and isolating. When we develop expertise in an area others don't value or understand, we gain a rich interior world but lose opportunities for connection. This tension between personal passion and social belonging drives many film lovers to seek communities where their knowledge is appreciated, whether in person or increasingly online. For adolescents especially, this isolation can feel acute. The awkward transition to womanhood, as portrayed in films like Smooth Talk, offers a mirror for real-life experiences while simultaneously shaping expectations. Joyce Carol Oates's story adaptation shows protagonist Connie's terrifying encounter with Arnold Friend, a predatory older man who knows everything about her and ultimately takes her for a drive from which she returns fundamentally changed. This narrative reflects the peril of emerging womanhood in a world where female bodies are objectified and vulnerable. Sexual education for many comes piecemeal, cobbled from school gossip and movie clues. Classic Hollywood films under the production code used visual metaphors instead of explicit content. Fireworks in To Catch a Thief, crashing waves in From Here to Eternity, or a train entering a tunnel in North by Northwest. These coded references created a language of desire that viewers had to interpret, often without guidance or context. The journey from solitary appreciation to finding community marks a crucial transition for many film lovers. When we discover others who share our passion, whether in person, through writing, or in digital spaces, we gain not just validation, but new perspectives that enrich our understanding. This movement from isolation to connection parallels the broader human journey toward finding our place in the world. Throughout film history, women have primarily been positioned as objects rather than subjects of the gaze. Laura Mulvey's concept of the male gaze describes how mainstream cinema adopts a male perspective, making men the viewers and women the viewed. As John Berger wrote, "Men look at women. Women watch themselves being looked at," creating a split identity where women constantly survey themselves as they imagine others see them. This dynamic creates particular challenges for women working in visual media. Malone recounts how, after successfully hosting a national broadcast early in her career, a producer told her she could have a real career in television if she just lost 10 kilograms. On YouTube, commenters analyzed everything from her appearance to her voice, calling her simultaneously too pretty and too ugly, too loud and too quiet. Even when discussing statistics about gender inequality in directing, she was labeled an ugly feminist or social justice warrior. The psychological impact of this constant scrutiny is profound. Despite knowing rationally that validation should come from within rather than from others, reading comments became almost an exercise in self-harm. A single negative comment could confirm worst fears, while even positive ones focused on appearance felt unhealthy. The unspoken goal of much commentary seems to be making women invisible. There are few things more threatening than a woman who refuses to stay within society's prescribed boundaries. Films like A Woman's Face explicitly tie women's exterior beauty to interior morality. When Joan Crawford's character, Anna, undergoes plastic surgery to remove facial scarring, her criminal tendencies disappear alongside her physical flaws. This narrative exemplifies how women's beauty has historically been treated as a character trait in cinema, with exterior appearance directly linked to moral worth. For female viewers, this creates shame as we turn these images back on ourselves, wondering what our own appearance says about our value. Throughout Hollywood history, films have dictated a narrow definition of female beauty, typically thin, symmetrically featured, smooth-skinned, young, able-bodied, cisgendered, and white. Philosopher Heather Widows describes this as an ethical standard, where beauty success becomes a moral virtue and beauty failure a moral vice. Because women rarely see natural female bodies in real life, we seek clues from media about what we should look like, internalizing these images despite knowing better. The ideal female body has shifted throughout history, often in response to women's political gains. Historians like Naomi Wolf argue that whenever women gain power, beauty standards become more restrictive, keeping women focused on appearance rather than political causes. As Wolf writes, "A culture fixated on female thinness is not an obsession about female beauty, but an obsession about female obedience." Reclaiming visual pleasure requires conscious resistance to these patterns. Before the Motion Picture Production Code, some women like Mae West and Marlene Dietrich partially reversed this objectification. West wrote her own roles as bold, brassy women who made the first move. Dietrich brought European sensuality to Hollywood with an androgynous quality and control over her sexuality, as seen in Morocco, 1930, where she confidently kisses a woman while wearing a tuxedo. These women weren't embarrassed by their femininity. They controlled their careers and their pleasure. The tension between professional ambition and societal expectations creates particular challenges for women. Most of the 9 Hepburn Tracy films followed a similar pattern. Katharine Hepburn played accomplished women who were ultimately humbled by Spencer Tracy's grounded characters. His ability to cut her down to size on screen revealed a vulnerability that helped revive her career after being labeled box office poison in 1938. Woman of the Year exemplifies this dynamic. Hepburn's Tess Harding is brilliant, multilingual, and accomplished, winning Outstanding Woman of the Year. The film's conflict arises when she proves to be an inattentive wife and negligent mother, adopting a refugee boy without consulting her husband Sam and then leaving him alone while attending her award ceremony. Sam eventually leaves, telling her, "America's Outstanding Woman of the Year isn't a woman at all." The original ending had Tess simply attending a baseball game to show interest in Sam's world, but producer Joseph Mankiev and director George Stevens worried audiences wouldn't be satisfied, fearing female viewers might resent this paragon of beauty, intelligence, wit, and accomplishment. They created a new ending where Tess attempts to make Sam breakfast, struggling comically with kitchen appliances. Hepburn vocally opposed this worst bunch of shit I've ever read, but eventually relented. The scene's saving grace comes when Sam clarifies he doesn't want her to be just Mrs. Sam Craig, suggesting instead she become Tess Harding Craig. This pattern of accomplished women being tamed persists in contemporary media, though often in subtler forms. The message remains consistent. Ambition and traditional femininity exist in tension, and women must ultimately choose or find compromise. What's striking is how these narratives shape real women's career choices and self-perception, creating internal conflicts between ambition and acceptance. Ingrid Bergman's real-life experience illustrates the consequences of defying convention. After seeing Roberto Rossellini's Italian neorealist films, she wrote him expressing desire to work together, eventually leading to their collaboration on Stromboli and a passionate affair that resulted in pregnancy. The public was outraged when she had her illegitimate son, Roberto, and she was exiled from Hollywood for 8 years, denounced even on the Senate floor. "No one but I can decide how I should live," she maintained, refusing to express regrets. Throughout classic Hollywood, marriage was a central concern in women's pictures, with the production code upholding the sanctity of marriage. Yet these films often showed the messiness of adult relationships while still presenting marriage as inevitable. This tension between acknowledging complexity and reinforcing convention creates a mixed legacy for viewers navigating their own life choices. Ingrid Bergman's real-life experience illustrates the consequences of defying convention. After seeing Roberto Rossellini's Italian neorealist films, she wrote him expressing desire to work together, eventually leading to their collaboration on Stromboli and a passionate affair that resulted in pregnancy. The public was outraged when she had her illegitimate son, Roberto, and she was exiled from Hollywood for 8 years, denounced even on the Senate floor. "No one but I can decide how I should live," she maintained, refusing to express regrets. Throughout classic Hollywood, marriage was a central concern in women's pictures, with the production code upholding the sanctity of marriage. Yet these films often showed the messiness of adult relationships while still presenting marriage as inevitable. This tension between acknowledging complexity and reinforcing convention creates a mixed legacy for viewers navigating their own life choices. The history of cinema cannot be separated from the history of racial representation and exploitation. Imitation of Life, 1934, provides a powerful case study in how films both reflected and reinforced racial hierarchies. Louise Beavers, who played the black housekeeper Delilah, appeared in 19 films in 1934 alone, mostly as servants. Despite transitioning from working as an actual maid to actress Leatrice Joy to playing maids on screen, Beavers brought dignity to her roles. The constraints placed on black performers were both explicit and implicit. Beavers had to cultivate a southern dialect she didn't naturally possess and was forced to gain weight or wear padding to fit the mammy stereotype. When possible, she pushed back against racism, such as insisting on removing a racial slur from the Imitation of Life script. Critics believed she deserved an Oscar nomination, though she never received one. Freddie Washington, who played Delilah's daughter Piola, knew the complexity of passing firsthand. With light skin and green eyes, she was advised to pass as white or something exotic for better roles, but refused, stating, "I would have swallowed whole hog the idea of black inferiority." Her principled stance limited her Hollywood career, and after Imitation of Life, she returned to stage work and helped establish the Negro Actors Guild to advocate for better roles for black performers. Imitation of Life resonated differently with white and black audiences. White viewers saw Piola as yearning to be white, while black audiences understood her frustration at racism and desire for equal opportunities. critics were divided. Sterling Brown criticized the film's stereotypes, calling Delilah straight out of Southern fiction, while Fanny Hurst defended her work by citing support from Black friends like Zora Neale Hurston. Langston Hughes responded with a satirical play, Limitations of Life, featuring a white servant happily massaging her Black employer's feet. These divergent interpretations highlight how films function differently depending on viewers' social positions and lived experiences. For marginalized audiences, watching mainstream cinema often involves a complex negotiation between pleasure and critique, enjoying aspects of films while recognizing their problematic representations. This double consciousness, as W.E.B. Du Bois might describe it, creates a particular relationship to media that majority viewers rarely experience. Understanding these hidden histories enriches our appreciation of cinema while challenging simplistic narratives about representation. The contributions of performers like Beavers and Washington, who brought dignity and complexity to roles within severe constraints, deserve recognition alongside more celebrated film histories. Their resistance within the system laid groundwork for later progress, even as they navigated painful compromises. Los Angeles, the epicenter of the film industry, embodies the tension between fantasy and reality that defines cinema itself. After moving there from Australia, Malone initially experienced the city as one giant movie set where everyday American sights, yellow school buses, red fire hydrants, seemed like movie props come to life. Every street felt like a familiar film location, every person a vaguely recognizable actor. The Kevin Bacon-ness of LA created a surreal atmosphere where everyone could connect themselves to celebrities within 6 degrees. Even ordinary professions had Hollywood connections. Accountants worked for studios, personal trainers served celebrities, and local businesses displayed headshots of famous clients. This notion of big breaks wasn't far-fetched in a city pulsing with ambition, where the air felt heavy with expectation that today might be someone's life-changing moment. After years in Los Angeles, however, the glamour began to fade. The rich cinema history Malone had dreamed about hadn't been preserved. Many famous landmarks and studio backlots had been torn down, while others had been co-opted by cheap tourism. The Chinese Theater looked like a bizarre movie set with street performers dressed as unrelated characters, Flash Gordon, the Hulk, Zorro, and an Uncanny Valley version of Tom Cruise's Maverick. The city seemed like a set in need of a refresh, the buildings mere facades that might crumble with a poke. This disillusionment parallels a broader journey many of us experience, the recognition that the narratives we've internalized don't fully align with reality. For Malone, this realization culminated during the pandemic, which cleared her calendar of endless events and created space for reflection. In the newfound quiet, her inner voice spoke clearly. "You need to be in nature. Live somewhere beautiful, peaceful, and quiet. Simplify your life." Having moved to Sydney at 18 for television work, then to Los Angeles at 29 for career advancement, she approached 40 contemplating a move solely for happiness. In October 2020, she packed her car and cat and drove 40-plus hours to a small East Coast town she'd only passed through once before. Within 3 days, she knew she wanted to stay. The town's leisurely pace, lack of modern conveniences, and genuine people helped her shed the stress of city life and rediscover herself beyond her professional persona. This journey toward authenticity often requires stepping away from the narratives we've absorbed, whether from films, social media, or cultural expectations, to discover what truly resonates with our deeper selves. Before turning 40, Malone bought her first house as a single woman, as the paperwork boldly stated, and set a new goal: own an old movie theater in a small town. This dream represented not escape into fantasy, but connection to community, creating space where film lovers could reunite after isolation while preserving classic cinema. The pandemic transformed many people's relationship with screens and entertainment. During lockdown, familiar classic films provided comfort amid uncertainty. Singin' in the Rain, The Apartment, Sabrina, whose predictable endings felt safe when the world didn't. Psychologist Christine Baccio explained that people find comfort in nostalgia during times of loss, anxiety, isolation, and uncertainty. studies showed over half of people returned to familiar entertainment during lockdown, while online cast reunions and drive-in theaters experienced a resurgence. Throughout Girls on Film, Malone explores how movies function simultaneously as mirrors reflecting our experiences and windows into other worlds. This dual nature gives cinema its unique power to both validate our reality and expand our understanding beyond it. At its best, film helps us process our emotions, connect with others' experiences, and imagine new possibilities for ourselves and society. Horror films, for instance, reflect our deepest fears while providing safe distance to process them. As a teen, Malone couldn't separate herself from horror movies, throwing up after films like A Nightmare on Elm Street and remaining sleepless, convinced Freddy Krueger would visit her. The most effective horror films tap into real-world anxieties of their era: Cold War fears in Invasion of the Body Snatchers, feminist awakening in The Stepford Wives, and suburban terrors in 1980s slasher films. For women especially, horror reflects everyday fears about dangerous men. Films also function as windows into experiences we might never have directly. World cinema opened Malone's mind to lives beyond her limited Australian existence, showing people and places both foreign and relatable. As Roger Ebert said, movies are like a machine that generates empathy, helping us identify with others on our shared human journey. This capacity to foster understanding across differences gives cinema profound social importance beyond entertainment. Perhaps most powerfully, films can transform how we see ourselves. After watching Amélie in 2001, Malone felt changed by seeing herself reflected in Audrey Tautou's dreamy, shy character with her wide eyes and rich imagination. If quiet Amélie could be the center of a movie, perhaps she could matter too. This validation of different ways of being in the world represents cinema's most personal impact, the moment when a character's journey helps us accept or reimagine our own. As we mature, our relationships with films evolve. Movies that once seemed straightforward entertainment reveal layers of meaning and problematic elements. Rather than providing simple answers, perhaps films serve best by prompting questions that help us process our past and evolve toward the future. The most enduring films grow with us, offering new insights each time we return to them from different life stages and perspectives. In a world increasingly mediated by screens, understanding our relationship with visual media becomes ever more crucial. By examining how films have shaped her identity, Malone invites us to consider our own cinematic influences, the stories that have molded our expectations, the characters who have inspired us, and the images that have defined our sense of possibility. This awareness doesn't diminish cinema's magic, but enriches it, allowing us to engage more consciously with the stories that surround us and those we choose to tell ourselves.